This podcast is part of the Big Heads Media Podcast Network. Go to bigheadsmedia.com for more great podcasts.
Hello, Internet, and welcome once again to Quiz and Hers, the trivia podcast where we test each other's knowledge and the strength of our relationship in a 10-week battle for glory. I'm your host today, Justin, and I'm here with your quiz mistress for the week, my wife, Hallie.
Hello.
Hello. How's it going?
Pretty good.
It's good. Dog's walking around making lots of noise in the background.
Yep.
Oh, well. Anyway, if you're new to the podcast, you will get used to the sound of the dog in the background, I'd imagine. And here's what we do. Each week, one of us writes six trivia questions to ask the other person, one from each of our six categories, which are arts and literature, times and places, sports and games, movies and TV, music, and everything else. After each question, Hallie will talk a little bit about the answer to teach us all a little more about whatever the subject might be. All the questions are always related to some common theme that usually unites the game in some way, and whoever has the most correct answers at the end of 10 weeks will be the Season 14 champion. So, last week, you had your first opportunity to answer questions, and you got four of them right, meaning that you're up 4-0 on this young season. And today is my first chance to try to put some points on the board. So, what do you got?
All right. Today's theme is the Wild Wild West.
The terrible Will Smith steampunk movie?
No, it's about the Wild West.
Oh, okay.
American West, if you will.
Okay, cool.
Yep.
The Wild West, if you will.
Yes.
As opposed to the Wild Wild West, which is that weird steampunk movie based on that weird steampunk TV series.
I just thought it would be a more fun name.
Okay.
I'm willing to take suggestions if you have a better name.
The Quiz Fight at the OK Podcast.
Okay, fine.
Because it's the gunfight at the OK Corral?
Yeah, I gotcha.
Okay, good. I assume that's probably one of the questions.
Nope.
Okay, then.
Okay. First question is music. First recorded by Bing Crosby in 1933, what song is sometimes considered the unofficial anthem of the American West and is now the state song of Kansas?
Oh, I think I know this. I have a guess. I would like it very much to be Country Roads, but that's obviously West Virginia, not Kansas.
I thought the song was called West Virginia.
It is.
Oh, okay.
No, it's probably Home on the Range, right?
Yep.
Where the Buffalo roam and all that.
It is Home on the Range.
Nice.
I almost called the game that, but then I was like,
but
that's,
wait, that's
an interesting
answer.
Question.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. So there's not enough really to say about the song for a full discussion. So I'm going to talk about Bing Crosby, about whom there is arguably too much to say, but, you know, we'll see what we can do.
I know two things about Bing Crosby. One, he was in that horrible movie that my grandmother likes to watch at Christmas, White Christmas.
Was he in White Christmas?
Yes. Or one of them.
I know he was in Holiday Inn.
Oh, that's
which
the one.
Was White Christmas, but
I
don't
them up.
Know if he was in White Christmas.
I don't know. I mixed them up. The other thing I know
that
about
would be a
him,
good thing to know, though. Hang
yes.
on.
The other I thing I know about him across. Is he was a wife beater. He's a bad dude.
So, I didn't talk about that, but I did mention briefly that he was bad. It looks like, yes. I think it might be a sequel?
Holiday Inn is a sequel to White Christmas.
No.
Vice versa.
I think so.
Okay. Whatever. He was in that movie, and he hit his wife. So, you can get fucked, as far as I'm concerned, Bing Crosby.
I don't think it's a sequel. I think it's just, like, also him and Danny Kaye, and also a Christmas movie.
Yay,
but they God. Both have the song White Christmas?
That all sounds terrible. I hate that song. And I hate that movie.
Okay.
Anyway, go on.
So, Harry Lillis Crosby Jr. was born on May 3rd, 1903 in Tacoma, Washington, and then moved to Spokane, where he grew up.
So his real first name was not the Microsoft search engine?
No.
Presumably he...
Or Cherry.
Right. Presumably he took the stage name out of an undying love for mediocre Google knockoffs.
Obviously.
Okay.
He was the fourth of seven children. Apparently, he got the nickname Bing after a comic character called Bingo from Bingville from the comic The Bingville Bugle, which I've never heard of.
What the fuck just came out of your mouth?
It was the early 1900s. He attended Gonzaga University in Spokane, but left after 3 years without finishing. When he was 20 years old, he joined a group called the Musicaliders, which played at dances, and then he joined a singing trio called the Three Harmony Aces with Al Rinker accompanying on piano. In 1925, he and Rinker moved to LA together to pursue music careers. Rinker's sister, singer Mildred Bailey, helped them find jobs, and they were spotted by a member of the Paul Whiteman Organization, which had bands and orchestras.
The Paul Whiteman Organization is my second favorite mafia.
Cool.
Sounds like a mafia, doesn't it?
Not with that name. Paul Whiteman?
What? All the mafia bosses were white.
Yeah, but they didn't have names like Whiteman. They had names like Italian names.
I suppose so.
They recorded and performed with the Paul Whiteman Organization for a while. When they traveled to New York, Crosby was part of a singing trio, the Rhythm Boys, and got to perform and record with people like Jimmy Dorsey and Hoagie Carmichael, which are names you may have heard.
I've heard the second one, not the first one.
I talked about him when I talked about Frank Sinatra.
Okay, then. I don't remember that.
Okay. In 1928, Crosby had his first number one hit with a jazz version of the song Old Man River from the show Showboat.
Right.
In 1930, he married Dixie Lee, and in 1931, he broke with the Rhythm Boys and signed a solo recording contract. It was at this point that his different singing style, which was softer and smoother than other singers at the time, lent itself to the new term crooner, so he was the one that they actually came up with the term for.
Right, he was the OG crooner.
They called it a conversational American style, which I guess I could see. Like, basically they were saying like Al Jolson and I'm not sure who else, like, were considered belters.
Right. Yeah, he doesn't
belt. Wasn't so showy.
He doesn't belty croons. Yeah, for sure.
Later that year, he became a hit while doing a weekly 15-minute radio show. Around this time, he was in his first full-length film, The Big Broadcast. In 1936, he replaced his old boss, Paul Whiteman, as host of the weekly NBC radio show Kraft Music Hall, a job he held for 10 years.
Of the White Man Organization.
Yes.
Yes.
Speaking of white and... I don't know, that was a terrible segue.
Speaking of white men, like this whole discussion is.
No, I was going to say, speaking of like racial, I don't even know, whatever. Crosby loved Louis Armstrong and wanted to be in a film with him. He was able to convince Columbia Pictures and his fellow actors to include Armstrong in the film, which helped Armstrong and other African Americans get more opportunities in the film business.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
That was my terrible segue.
Yeah, that wasn't a good segue.
It makes sense now. You literally said white man.
Yeah. But so he did some good stuff in addition to all the bad stuff he did. That's good.
Yes.
I guess.
During World War II, Crosby performed for the troops, and in a poll of U.S. troops after the war, Crosby was voted the number one person for GI morale, above FDR and Bob Hope.
That's right. That was the third thing I knew about him, was that he was really involved in, like, the USO stuff. I forgot about that.
Yep. Crosby's biggest hit, of course, was 1941's White Christmas, which was written by Irving Berlin, which I talked about in my Irving Berlin discussion, which was in my Centenarians episode 100.
Yes.
The song then appeared in the 1942 film Holiday Inn, which starred Crosby and Danny Kaye. White Christmas is also the best-selling single of all time.
I almost just did a spit take. You're kidding me.
What?
That it's the number one selling single ever?
I said Bing that Crosby's in my discussion of Irving Berlin.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
I must have hated it then, too, because I blocked it out. That's horrifying.
At least it's not All I Want for Christmas.
No, but that has some other weird record. Like, it's charted the most consecutive years or something.
I don't know.
Something like that. Ugh.
I'll talk about Mariah Carey one day.
Please don't.
I have to.
Ugh. All right, continue.
Crosby starred in a lot of other movies besides Holiday Inn. He starred in the Road 2 musical comedies with Bob Hope and Dorothy L'Amour, including Road to Singapore and Road to Morocco. There were seven of them.
Oh, yeah, I've heard of those, I think.
Okay. After that, Crosby and Hope were considered a comedy duo. In 1937, Crosby starred in the film Waikiki Wedding, for which he sang the songs Sweet Leilani, which won the Oscar for Best Original Song, as well as Blue Hawaii, which Elvis recorded over 20 years later.
Right.
In 1944, Crosby starred in the film Going My Way, for which he won the Oscar for Best Actor. He also sang the song Swinging on a Star for the film, which won the Oscar for Best Original Song.
And Best Picture, right?
Oh,
I think. What year?
Does it matter? You should know who won.
I'm pretty sure Going My Way won Best Picture.
It's 1944.
Yeah.
Cool. In 1945, he was in the sequel, The Bells of St. Mary's, for which he was nominated for Best Actor but didn't win. He is one of a very small group of people who have been nominated for two Oscars for playing the same character.
Oh, that's interesting.
The only other one I could think of, this was like a Jeopardy question once, a final, was Al Pacino.
For Michael Corleone.
I assume.
Yeah.
I could pull up the list if you want.
That's okay. That would be an interesting discussion on its own. Just like weird Oscar.
He was in another interesting Oscar question that was like, who, hold on. Okay. At the time of recording in 2006, there was a question. Two of the four people who had Billboard number one pop album and also won a regular acting Oscar.
To be clear, it is not 2006 right now. You're saying that's when this Jeopardy question was asked.
Was that
asked.
Unclear? Sorry.
You said at time of recording in 2006.
Of Jeopardy. Of sorry.
This episode of Jeopardy that you
we
just
We come
looked
from
up.
The past.
Right. Okay.
No, in a 2006 Jeopardy, there was a question, which I don't know if there are more now, but there were four people who had a Billboard number one pop album and also won a regular acting Oscar. And the other three were Frank Sinatra, Barbra Streisand, and Jamie Foxx. And then there were also four men nominated. That this was in 2001, four men nominated twice for playing the same character were him, Paul Newman, Al Pacino, and Peter O'Toole.
There you go.
Which are really interesting facts.
Yeah.
Anyway, thank you, Jeopardy. In the 50s, he started doing telefilms and other TV specials. His last TV special was Merry Old Christmas in 1977, on which he recorded a duet of The Little Drummer Boy and Peace on Earth with David Bowie.
What?
Unfortunately, Crosby didn't live to see it air. But isn't that interesting?
David Bowie, of all people.
I know.
Okay.
Apparently, David Bowie's mom was a big fan of Bing Crosby.
Ugh, of course she was.
I'm sorry, mum.
Right.
Outside of his singing and acting career, Crosby was also an avid golfer. In 1950, he became the third person to win the William D. Richardson Award, which is given to a non-professional golfer who makes significant contributions to the sport. He was also inducted into the World Golf Hall of Fame in 1978, and along with Bob Hope, received the Bob Jones Award, the highest award of the United States Golf Association for distinguished sportsmanship. He had seven children with two wives, Dixie Lee, who died from ovarian cancer in 1952, and actress Catherine Grant, whom he married in 1957. He had many affairs and also had problems with alcohol and gambling. I didn't mention the
wife. And violence.
I didn't see that, but okay, I
That's
believe you.
That's widely known, yes.
In 1977, he fell off the stage after videotaping a concert to celebrate his 50th year in show business. He ruptured a disc in his back and spent a month in the hospital. 6 months later, he traveled to Spain to play golf. While walking back from golfing with his friends, he collapsed and died instantly from a massive heart attack.
Hmm.
He was buried at Holy Cross Cemetery in Culver City, California.
Okay.
So yeah, lots of good facts.
Yep, okay. Cool.
Okay. Question two is everything else. What Fortune 500 company, whose logo is a gladiator, got the first contract for a transcontinental stage line to carry mail from Missouri to California and then got into financial services in the money order business?
Yeah, I know. It's a good question.
Thank you.
I'm not sure. I don't know if I would have gotten it without the gladiator clue, but it's American Express.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think if I hadn't put that in, it would have been possibly Wells Fargo.
So that probably would have been my guess, if not for that
That's
clue.
That's why I had
but
to
it,
add.
But it still would have been wrong. It just wouldn't have been a very fair question.
Exactly. I had right. to make it fair.
Yeah. Okay. And that, you know, that makes sense. It's weird now because we think of them as a credit card company. Like, why is their name American Express? They're not Express doing anything. They're
right.
just, but this is why, right? Because they were originally in like shipping or whatever. Not shipping, but transport.
I'll tell you.
Yeah.
So American Express is a multinational financial services company that was founded in 1850. It is one of the 30 companies in the Dow Industrial Average, and it is listed on the New York Stock Exchange as AXP, if that ever comes up.
Which it does sometimes, stock symbols.
Yep.
Yeah.
American Express began as an express mail business in Buffalo, New York, and was founded by the merger of companies owned by Henry Wells, William G. Fargo, and John Warren Butterfield. So literally the Wells Fargo guys were involved.
Huh. But well, but it's not Wells Fargo.
No,
okay.
Wells Fargo Co. was started as a separate company in 1852 by Wells and Fargo after Butterfield refused to extend American Express's operations to California. But isn't that cool that they were in the founding of both?
Yeah, that is interesting. I didn't know that.
So I guess if it would be a good trivia question, like what other company did Wells and Fargo found?
Right, besides the obvious.
Right.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah, that was a big mistake. That's all. On the part of Butterfield.
Well, yeah, no kidding.
Can you imagine? They could have been one thing.
And the control of the banking and finance sector could be even more centralized than it is already in the U.S.
Yep. That comes up later.
Might actually be a good thing that that didn't happen.
Yep. But they did pretty much have a monopoly on express shipments in New York State for many years. In 1857, they started a money order business to compete with the United States Post Office's money orders. I don't know if anyone has that now, or is it just the post office?
No, they do. There are private money order companies. Like, if you go to, like, a grocery store customer service, you can usually buy a money order, but it's not going to be a postal money order. It'll be
Cash. Oh.
What?
There's another word. Cash. Cashier's check. No, that's not a cashier.
No, that's a bank.
That's only from a bank.
That's right. So you can get money orders from private companies.
Okay. That would be an interesting discussion.
Money orders?
Just like those ways of paying people that are not normal ways of paying people.
So I have thought about doing that, and
it's so confusing.
I did a little bit of reading, and I still don't understand what the difference is between a money order and a cashier's check, except where you get it.
We had to get a money order for, like, the moving company.
Yep.
And that was from a post office.
Right. For some reason, they said they only take postal money orders. Like, they don't take private industry money orders, which is such
this
a strange restriction.
This whole thing is so confusing.
All right. Maybe I'll talk about it at some point.
That would be cool. Thank you. Don't trust me to do it.
Probably not, but I'll see.
Please don't trust me to do it.
All right.
In 1874, they moved headquarters from Hudson Street in New York City to the upcoming financial district. And today it's headquartered in Lower Manhattan.
Along with every other company that does this kind of stuff.
Yeah. In the late 1880s, Fargo went to Europe and found it very difficult to obtain cash, even though he was the president of American Express and had letters of credit with him. After that, he enlisted Marcellus Fleming Berry to help him come up with a better solution, and he came up with the traveler's check, which was launched in 1891.
I've heard that fact before, actually, yeah.
So that's really interesting. Because American Express was basically the only company to honor letters of credit from different banks, the British government made them their official agent at the beginning of World War I. During the war, they have delivered money, letters, and relief packages to British prisoners of war.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. In 1917, the U.S. had a severe coal shortage, and all existing express companies were ordered to consolidate into one company to help serve the country's needs. And the result was the American Railway Express Agency. So basically, Woodrow Wilson was like, the competition is, like, fucking with the shipments of coal. Like, you all have to merge, which is so counterintuitive
to like, capitalism. Econ 101. Yeah, right. Econ 101 would say that competition should make things more efficient.
But not in this case.
Huh.
They all merged.
I bet there are really interesting economic analyses of that decision that come to very different conclusions depending on who wrote them.
Yeah, but American Express had like the largest share in this new thing.
Okay, because it was such a big company already at the time.
Right.
Yeah.
In 1957, American Express finally got into the card business. The first cards were made of paper with the account number and card member's name typed on it. In 1959, they were the first company to issue embossed plastic cards.
And bank cards, credit cards, whatever you want to call them, they were still fairly new in the 50s. Like, they were actually...
They were only the second company after... Hang on.
Discover, I think?
No.
No?
Something that doesn't exist. Hang on one second.
Oh, you mean the very first one? Diners Club?
I think that's it.
Hang on. Yeah, the very first credit card was from Diners Club. I know that. That's a classic trivia question.
Yeah, so Diners Club launched a card in March 1950. That was the first card.
Credit card, yeah.
Yes. Then American Express started to think about it. And then they decided to get into the business, and it took them until 1957. But from what I can tell, it seems like they were the second one, I think.
Okay, interesting.
Anyway, in 1966, they introduced the gold card, and in 1984, the platinum card. The platinum card was only offered by invitation to American Express customers who had been with them at least 2 years, spent a significant amount, and had excellent payment history. Now you can request to get a platinum card, but I think you still have to have those things to get approved.
Right, but the black card now is by invitation only, right?
Oh, maybe. I didn't read about that.
It's the super exclusive one. For, like, really rich people. I think the official name is the Centurion card, but everybody just calls it the Black Card.
That's cool.
And it was, like, for a long time, people thought it was a myth, because it was so exclusive, like, no one had ever actually seen it or knew anyone who had it. But it does exist.
Interesting. And I feel like I have it because that credit card we have is so heavy.
That is not an American Express card and is certainly not by invitation only. It's just a regular credit card. It's just really heavy.
It's weird. It makes me feel special, but it's also like too heavy.
It's just a Visa.
Yep.
It's fine. It's not.
Love a good Visa.
It's not fancy.
I'm a Visa girl.
Okay. That's a weird thing to have a brand loyalty to.
Anyway.
You're a Baltimore Ravens and Visa fan.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. Unrelated to their financial business, American Express partnered with Warner Communications in 1979 to create MTV, Nickelodeon, and the Movie Channel.
Wait, what?
You heard those words.
I
did. That came out of my mouth.
I heard them. I'm not sure I believed them.
Yep.
Okay.
In 1984, the properties were sold to Viacom.
There you go. Okay.
But it's pretty weird that it was American Express.
So weird.
Also, American Express published the Travel and Leisure, Food and Wine, Executive Travel, Black Ink, and Departures magazines until 2013 when they sold them to Time Inc.
Food and Wine?
Yep. 2013.
The magazine we subscribe to.
The one magazine we subscribe to.
The only one. Wow. I had no idea. That's so odd.
Yep. Super weird. In the 80s and early 90s, they tried to get merchants and restaurants to only accept American Express by offering a lower interchange fee, which means credit card fee, basically.
Right. There's a processing fee to accept a credit card.
Right.
That's how the credit card companies make money, basically. Well, right. That and interest. Mostly interest, I guess. But
in response, a group of restaurants in Boston stopped accepting American Express in what was called the Boston Fee Party. I didn't make that up.
I know. I wasn't sighing at you, I was sighing at just all of that. But there's still businesses that don't take American Express now, right? Like,
yes.
You hear, like...
That's what I was thinking.
Doesn't MasterCard use it as part of their advertising? It's like, and they don't take American Express or whatever.
I don't know, but I think it's interesting, though, that they were trying to get people to only take American Express, and now there are places that still don't take it.
That's the most Boston...
But less than when I was growing up, I feel like it was a lot of places.
Yes,
because my dad had one, and it would always be like, oh, they don't take American Express.
Yes.
But definitely less and less.
Yes. That is the most Boston shit ever, by the way, that they lowered the fee to try to be competitive and so that restaurants would only take them, and the restaurants in Boston just gave them the middle finger and said, fuck you, we're not going to take your damn card now.
Yep.
That's awesome.
But about 250 other restaurants around the country followed them, and American Express decided to focus on acceptance rather than exclusivity, which makes a lot of sense.
I agree.
Yes.
They flew too close to the sun, like Daedalus.
Yeah.
Icarus.
I think...
Icarus, damn it.
I think they're fine. I don't know. You have one.
I never use it. I have their, like, everyday card, the one that doesn't have a fee, because most of their cards have annual fees, which is the reason that I don't particularly want one, but
I guess
their...
they're for, like, really rich people?
Yes, they are. And, yeah, so I have their, like, everyday card that doesn't have a fee, and I never use it, because the rewards are not that good.
Yeah.
They're not as good as our other cards that we
have. It's interesting that they're not as focused on that, but
yeah.
I don't know. In the early 80s, they acquired Shearson Loeb Rhodes and then Lehman Brothers Kuhn Loeb, which made them Shearson Lehman / American Express.
Oh, God, I hate that.
Yep. In 1983, they acquired Trade Development Bank in Geneva. And in 1993, they decided to get out of the investment banking business completely. In January 2021, an investigation was launched by the Department of the Treasury, the FDIC, and the Federal Reserve into whether American Express misled potential corporate customers while selling their cards.
I bet they did.
And it was like 2015, 2016. Is that when you got it?
No, I got a couple years before that, I think.
Okay, well, that was all.
I got it like when I was in graduate school, so it would have been a little before that.
Yes, that's it.
Okay. We here at Quiz and Hers are happy to accept American Express if you want to financially support the show.
That is true. All right, question three is sports and games.
Okay.
What shooting sport uses pistols and is based on the glamorized art of gunslingers in the Old West, although they use blanks or wax bullets? You don't have to get all of them, Justin. It's okay.
I'd like to.
I would not like that.
Okay. Shooting sport. So, okay, well, it's not one of the Olympic ones because they're all riflery. It's not skeet shooting, because that's, like, shotguns, I think? I didn't know there was a name for this. Like, I know what you're talking about. I can picture it, but I didn't realize there was, like, a term for it. I doubt this is it, but all I can think of is I've heard it referred to as, like, trick shooting. So, that I guess that's my guess. I'm sure that's wrong, but...
It is wrong.
Okay, what is it?
It's fast draw or quick draw.
Really?
Yeah, it's a thing.
I've certainly heard quick draw as a term. I've never heard it refer to a particular sport. That, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
So, I mean, there's not really that much to say about fast draw, so we're going to do an overview of all shooting sports.
Excellent.
Yes.
We'll kill several birds with one bullet, if you will.
Yeah, there's not really enough about any of them to do a whole discussion, in my opinion, so this is good.
Right. Okay, cool.
So first, let's talk about the arms that are used, which can either be firearms or air guns. Like, airsoft.
Right.
Guns. First is the handgun, which is a small arm. The two types of handguns are pistols and revolvers. They are lighter than longer guns, but have less accuracy. Then there are rifles, which are long and require the use of both hands and a stock to brace it against the shoulder. Lastly, shotguns are similar to rifles, but are larger in caliber.
And they're for much shorter distances.
Right.
Because usually shotgun ammo is like pellets, so it scatters.
That's what I was about to say. Right. So shotguns usually fire a shell, which contains smaller projectiles called shots, or one large projectile called a slug.
Like a deer slug, yeah.
Yeah. So now on to the different types of shooting sports. The first kind, of course, is bullseye shooting. In bullseye shooting, the distances are usually 10, 25, 50, 100, 200, or 300 meters from the target. Bullseye shooting is an event in the Summer Olympics.
And that's what it's called? Bullseye shooting?
Correct.
I've watched an awful lot of Summer Olympics. I don't think I've ever heard that term.
Yeah, I don't know what they call it.
Okay.
Another type is field shooting, aka terrain shooting. It either involves pistols or rifles, and unlike bullseye shooting, uses temporary shooting ranges at varying distances. So, like, there's no set distance.
Right, okay.
The next type is called rapid fire shooting, one type of which is fast draw, which I mentioned in the question. In Scandinavia, there are rapid fire rifle competitions called Fältskytting and Stängskytting. That's definitely not trivia relevant, but I thought I'd torture myself anyway.
Nailed it.
Thank you. Another shooting sport is clay target, mainly clay pigeons shooting.
Like skeet shooting.
Yeah, so there are actually three of these events in the Olympics.
Oh.
Trap, double trap, and skeet.
Oh, I've heard of trap shooting. Yeah, okay.
In trap and double trap, one or two targets, respectively, are thrown from 15 meters in front of the shooter. So trap is one and double trap is two. In skeet, targets are thrown from two throwers called traps, placed 40 meters apart.
That's the difference between those.
Yes.
I'll be honest, I just thought trap shooting and skeet shooting were the same thing.
Not quite.
So there you go.
But it's cool, like I can summarize these real quick.
Yeah, this is good.
I thought so. Then there's running target shooting, which is basically what you're thinking.
Like a carnival game.
Sort of. There's a moving target, sometimes called a boar, deer, or moose, that is built to move like a running animal.
Yeah, sure. Yep. Okay.
Another type is practical shooting, aka action shooting or dynamic shooting. In this type, the shooter is also moving. So in running target shooting, you're not moving, the target's
moving. The shooter is stationary and the target is moving.
Right.
Huh.
And the main group for practical shooting is the International Practical Shooting Confederation, considered the Formula One of shooting sports.
I don't understand what that means.
It's just like a high-level thing.
Oh, okay.
Competition.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Next, there is long-range shooting, which is pretty self-explanatory. Full-bore target shooting has targets at ranges from 300 to 1,200 yards. Precision rifle competitions involve moving and shooting from different positions with a time limit.
Hmm.
The organization dedicated to it in the United States is the National Rifle League. So if you ever hear National Rifle League, that's what it is.
Not to be confused with the National Rifle Association, which is a very powerful political lobbying group.
Right, but I heard National Rifle League somewhere recently, so I thought I should include it.
I don't know where, but okay.
Okay. Another type is bench rest shooting, which involves shooters sitting on a chair with the rifle supported on a table.
Yeah, I've seen that.
Yeah. Then there's metallic silhouette, in which shooters shoot at animal-shaped silhouettes, which must be knocked down to score. So that's like a carnival game.
That's literally that game you've all played at the carnival.
Right.
Okay.
I had a moment where I was like, should I talk about carnival games? And then I looked it up and I was like, there's not enough.
That would be an interesting discussion, but...
The internet had less about it than I could come up with from my brain.
That's surprising.
I know, right?
Huh.
What's your favorite?
Any of the ones where you have to hold on the target? Because I was really
like
good
at the balloon and the clown.
The balloon or the racing rabbits or whatever. Yes. I was really good at like finding the target quickly and then staying on it nice and steady, and I would always win those because the trick was to correct your shot quickly, and I was very good at that.
Okay, that's fair.
What about you?
I was pretty good at those. I don't know. All I remember from childhood is, I don't think I saw this anywhere else, but at the Adventureland that's on Long Island,
mm-hmm.
they have this game where you have these rubber frogs and you fold them in half.
Oh, yeah, I know this.
Very rare.
It's hard as fuck.
They don't have that anywhere, really.
Yeah.
And then you hit a hammer on a little thing that projects
the frog.
It shoots the frog
up.
And it has to land on the lily pad.
Yeah.
My dad won that game every single time we went to Adventureland.
How? It's hard as fuck.
He's really good at it.
Good for him. That's a weird...
I know,
weird,
I always thought that was super cool.
Weird, not very marketable skill, but cool.
Yes.
All right.
He had a weird skill for that game.
Okay.
Just a fun fact.
Should we get back to guns
and
stuff?
Oh, my brother always liked the one where you climb up a ladder, but
Guess
it always
not.
Flips you upside down.
Okay.
That's all.
All right.
I wasn't good at anything.
Okay. More guns?
More guns.
Okay.
Western shooting, which is different from fast draw. There are two types, which are cowboy action shooting and cowboy mounted shooting. Cowboy action shooting is basically the same as practical shooting, but with cowboy-themed props.
Of course.
Cowboy mounted shooting is a competitive equestrian sport in which blank ammunition is used to break a target balloon, but you're riding a horse.
What?
You heard me.
Okay, that's one that I think I would want to watch.
Right?
That actually sounds pretty cool.
I know, we should have gone to the rodeo.
Like, most of these don't sound that interesting as spectator sports. I certainly, like, I respect the skill involved, and having not really ever handled guns, I don't think I would be good at any of these, but I respect people who can do this, but that one actually sounds really entertaining.
I agree. Our town weirdly has a rodeo, which is weird because we don't live in the West area.
No, we live, like, just north of the tropics, but
yep.
Yes, we do have a rodeo grounds
in our town. We missed it. Maybe next year. Another category of shooting sports is athletic shooting sports, which combine shooting with other sports like cross-country skiing or cycling, which is insane.
I was wondering when you were going to get to this. Yeah.
My favorite one is called the Moose Biathlon, in which they do cross-country skiing and rifle shooting at paper targets of moose.
Okay, but that's not the Olympic one. The Olympic one is the biathlon,
right,
which is just cross-country skiing and then target shooting.
Right.
Yeah.
Archery and dart shooting sports are also considered shooting sports, but we've already discussed those.
We have.
There are also what are known as confrontational shooting sports, which include paintball, airsoft, and laser tag, but we could talk about those another time.
And dueling, I suppose, but that's out of fashion now.
Yeah, I'm talking about modern.
Right. I guess dueling was not considered a sport.
I would
it
not.
Was,
if I was going to talk about dueling, I would definitely not put it in the sports and
no,
games
that
category.
No, that would be times and places for sure.
That would be an interesting one.
It would.
But yeah. I think paintball could deserve its own discussion.
Yeah, paintball, airsoft, laser tag, those are definitely worth thinking and talking about at some point.
Have you ever balled the paint?
I have never balled the paint. I have, however, tagged the laser.
Same.
And I have...
It's fun.
I have not competitively softed the air, although I have fired an airsoft gun a few times. They're cool.
Oh, I have a good story.
All right.
When I was in high school, my brother was desperate to get an airsoft gun, so he got one.
I know this story, but go on, because the listeners don't.
And then my best friend was over, and we were just watching TV, and my brother was like, want to try the airsoft gun? And my friend was like, sure. And then they go outside, and they come in, and my friend's all upset, and I'm like, what happened? He was like, we decided we should see if what happens if he just shoots the airsoft gun from, like, an inch away from my arm.
Right, point-blank range, what happens if you fire an airsoft gun?
Basically, he had
nothing
a, big,
good.
A big mark, and he was in a lot of pain, and I was like, you two are idiots, and that was
right.
It.
No shit.
Boys are dumb. That's the moral of the story. The friend was a boy. The brother was a boy.
Boys will be boys.
Boys will be boys. I was just watching TV, living my life.
Not getting shot with airsoft pellets.
Yeah. Good decisions.
All right. So, that's halftime then. We are halfway through the game. I have two correct answers out of three. And this is when we take a short break, first of all, to thank you guys for listening. We really do appreciate you spending some time with us. More time than usual. I feel like this game is taking a while because we're going off on terrible, awful, irrelevant tangents, but that's all right.
That's fun.
It is. If you think that's fun and you're enjoying these tangents, be sure to like and subscribe and give us a rating and a review in whatever your preferred podcast app is. It really does help us to grow the audience a bit. If you would like to get in touch with us, we are available by email. We are quizandhers@gmail.com. And we are admittedly a very small, independent podcast, so we don't get a lot of emails. So we will answer you if you email us. Maybe not immediately, but certainly within a few days. So feel free to reach out. We love hearing from fans. If you are not an email type person, if you're more of a social media person, we are at Quiz and Hers on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can follow and interact with us there. Any of those would be great ways to send us submissions for our segment Fact or Fucked, where you can submit your favorite weird facts or your favorite made-up things that sound like weird facts, and you can see if you stump us, and of course we will give you a shout-out on the show for that.
Yep.
And as we say every week, we are proud members of the Big Heads Media Podcast Network. Check them out at bigheadsmedia.com. You can find merchandise there with our hand-drawn logo, lovingly designed by my wife and co-host. And you can get it on t-shirts, hoodies, tank tops, coffee mugs, trucker hats, I think, for some reason. Lots of stuff. So if you want to support the show financially, that's a good way to do it. And while you're there, be sure to check out one of the other great podcasts on the Big Heads Media Network. We have podcasts about literally everything. There are tons of sports podcasts, lots of pop culture, and also some informational podcasts in this same vein. So be sure to check them out. And to get you started, we're going to send you over to an ad from one of them now.
The Lisp Game is a conversational improv game. Each of our panel members has a list of topics and or phrases that were drawn from the chicken hat. Their goal is to sneak those topics and phrases into the conversation with a tangent. Another member of the panel can call you out saying, "That's on your list." If they're right, they get a point. If you bluffed or if they're just wrong, you get a point.
Catch the Lisp Game wherever you listen to podcasts.
All right, we are back. And let's see if I can at least get two more and tie you on the season in the back half of the game.
We shall see.
All right.
All right. Question 4. Movies and TV. What 1969 Western film is about outlaws who run away to Bolivia after executing several train robberies in the Wyoming area?
It's Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, right? At least I think they escaped the country.
Is that your guess?
Yes.
It is. Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
All right.
Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid came out in 1969 and starred Paul Newman as Robert Leroy Parker, a.k.a. Butch Cassidy, and Robert Redford as Harry Longabaugh, a.k.a. the Sundance Kid.
Are you going to talk about how they reunited for another better movie later?
No, they were in so many movies together.
Well,
Cassidy or Paul Newman and Robert Redford?
No,
the actors?
Yeah.
They were in so many movies
No,
together.
I know, but...
Weren't they, like, best friends?
Yes, but one of them is considered a spiritual successor. All right, forget it.
What is it?
One of my absolute favorite movies, The Sting.
No, I didn't talk about The Sting.
All right,
But I probably talked about it when I talked about Robert Redford.
You probably did. It's considered, like, a spiritual sequel, even though it's obviously different characters, different time. It's very similar, like, tonally.
Excuse me, I'm putting Paul Newman on my list right now.
Yes, good. Good call. All right, you've got dibs on Paul Newman. Salad dressing.
Controversial, but not really controversial opinion, Paul Newman is the best looking man to have ever lived.
That is madness.
Oh, try me.
Robert Redford, for one.
Have you seen Paul Newman? Have you seen him?
Yes.
Oh my god, he's so much better looking than Robert Redford.
That's ludicrous.
No, you're wrong.
That is absolute insanity.
You are so wrong. I'm going to actually get an internet poll going, and I'm going to be right.
You don't run our Twitter, I do, so you don't know how to run a Twitter poll, but...
You do the Twitter poll, and I am so right. Are you freaking crazy?
All right. When this comes out, I'll post a Twitter poll.
This is not controversial whatsoever.
It's Robert Redford. Get fucked.
You think Robert Redford's the best-looking man ever?
No, I'm saying he trumps Paul Newman, and so your argument already fails.
No. Paul Newman is the best-looking man.
Literally, the second person in this discussion... defeats your argument.
Paul Newman is the best looking man
right,
to ever.
Whatever. Heard. Continue. We will sort this out the only way we know how, which is a poll of our Twitter followers.
You are so wrong. All okay. Right. Oh, the film is loosely based on real outlaws with the same names.
Correct.
The film is set in 1899 Wyoming, where Butch Cassidy is the leader of the Hole in the Wall gang, which was also a real thing.
Correct.
In the beginning of the film, the gang chooses Harvey Logan as their new leader, and he challenges Butch to a knife fight. Harvey Logan sounds like a comic book person.
Well, you're thinking of Harvey Dent and Wolverine.
Oh, yes. Thank you.
That's why.
Thank you.
Wolverine, of course, his name is Logan. Yes.
Does he have a last name?
Well, it's not his real name. He has amnesia. It's a whole thing. Don't worry about
it. We should talk about this.
All right. You can add that to your list, too.
Oh, maybe I'm just curious. Maybe I should just watch that movie.
Logan?
Yeah.
I haven't seen it. Maybe but either. Apparently it's really good. So, yeah, okay. I would like to watch that.
Okay.
Okay.
I said he challenged Butch to a knife fight.
You did.
Butch beats him in the fight, but agrees to use his idea of robbing the Union Pacific train, the Overland Flyer, both on its eastward and westward trips. After the first robbery goes well, Butch spends the night with his lover, a schoolteacher named Etta Place, played by Catherine Ross. Random fun fact about Catherine Ross, she's been married to Sam Elliott for 37 years.
Good for them.
She was also very pretty. I mean, she's fine now, but sorry, that was mean.
That was very ageist.
I know. She's very nice looking. Okay. Anyway, back to the plot. During the second train robbery, Butch uses too much dynamite to blow open the safe, and the entire baggage car is destroyed. As the gang is trying to collect all the money, another train arrives with six lawmen who pursue the gang. They ask Sheriff Bledsoe for amnesty, but he tells them that he can't, and their best option is to leave. Butch and Sundance, while being pursued, jump off a cliff into a river. Butch then convinces Sundance and Etta, his lover, to flee to Bolivia. When they get there, Sundance doesn't like it, but Butch is optimistic. In Bolivia, they become successful robbers known as Los Bandidos Yankees, which means, like, Yankee Bandits.
The Yankee Bandits, yeah, that's good.
But they are worried that they are still being hunted and decide to get real jobs as guards for a mining company. At work, they get ambushed by other bandits and end up killing them. Etta then leaves them and goes back to the U.S., which is understandable. After that, they steal again and get into a gunfight with the local police. They take cover in a building and the Bolivian army arrives, but they think they can escape and they charge out of the building, guns a-blazing. The film ends on a freeze frame of them being fired at by the Bolivian troops.
Quite famously.
Yes.
Yeah.
The script was written by William Goldman, who also wrote the screenplay for All the President's Men, as well as the novels Marathon Man and The Princess Bride, both of which he adapted for film.
Yeah, those are very different books.
I'm killing it with the trivia relevance here. Right?
Goldman, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
For a second, I was like, didn't that guy write Lord of the Flies?
No, that's Golding.
I know. Yeah. But I had a moment.
No, I've had that moment as well.
Yeah.
In my past, yeah.
Yep. The role of Sundance was first offered to Jack Lemmon, who rejected it because he felt like he'd played too many similar characters already. I just thought that was fun. Fact.
I can't think of any similar role that Jack Lemmon played, but okay.
I don't know. I'll talk about him. Oh, I could put him on the list too.
Wow, you're killing it today with new things to talk about.
My movies and TV list is too many white men.
My movies and TV list is so short. I have like three things on it.
Oh, okay, cool. My longest list is arts and literature.
Let me check mine. Hang on.
And then music is also pretty long.
Yeah, same. My longest is arts and literature. My second longest is music.
My third longest is times and places.
My third longest is everything else closely followed by times and places.
What's your shortest? Mine, sports and games. I only have one.
Movies and TV. I literally have two things.
Wow.
I have like six. A dozen things on sports and games.
Wow. I have six movies and TV, five of which are white men.
Yeah, one of which is right.
A not white man. Well, this okay. is bad.
Mm.
We gotta talk about some women.
Yeah.
Anyway, the film premiered on September 23rd, 1969.
Nice.
Shut up. And became the number one film in the U.S. and Canada for 2 weeks. It became the top grossing film of the year. I was going to say 1969 again, but I didn't want to hear it.
Nice.
Shush. It was nominated for 7 Academy Awards and won 4 for Best Original Screenplay, Best Cinematography, Best Original Score, and Best Original Song for Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head, which I did not know was from that movie.
Me neither. That's a terrible song.
Good fact, though.
Good fact. Bad song.
That's the hidden theme.
Songs? Bad songs?
Oscars.
Ah.
Okay, you've gotten three?
Three.
Question 5 is times and places. The Louisiana Purchase, which opened up much of America to westward expansion, also included small portions of which two Canadian provinces, north of Montana and North Dakota? They can't all be easy, man.
See, I should know this. I should be able to just conjure up a mental map of Canada, because this comes up all the time, and I should be able to just work my way from the Pacific inward until I hit the right ones, but... okay, so... Montana... You said north of Montana?
Montana and North Dakota.
Okay, so it's gonna be... it's gonna be prairie provinces, then. Okay, so the Prairie Provinces, probably not in the right order, are Saskatchewan, Manitoba, and Alberta. So I need to pick two of those, basically. And I have nothing to inform this guess. So if my math is right, I basically have a 1 in 6 chance by just grabbing two of them. No, 1 in 3, because the order doesn't matter. Okay. It's a combination, not a permutation. I'll talk about that one day.
I've completely zoned out. Just say two things.
Ugh, God. All right, fine. Manitoba and Saskatchewan.
No.
Fuck!
Alberta and Saskatchewan.
God fuck damn it. That
oh my God, you already
sucks.
Got three. Get over yourself.
That sucks.
So sorry. That's something you should know.
What?
Like you said, you need a mental map.
Okay, do you have it?
Nope.
I didn't think so.
Something I should know as well.
All right, I agree.
Okay.
All right.
The Louisiana Purchase in 1803 was the acquisition of territory of Louisiana from Napoleonic France. The territory of Louisiana.
Yes.
France had ceded the territory to Spain in 1762 in the secret treaty of Fontainebleau at the end of the Seven Years' War. What? You're laughing at how I said Fontainebleau?
Fontainebleau!
In 1795, the U.S. and Spain signed Pinckney's Treaty, which gave American merchants use of the port of New Orleans for keeping goods for export. Then in 1800, Spain ceded the territory back to France in the Third Treaty of San Ildefonso. In 1803, Pierre Samuel Dupont de Nemours, a French nobleman, helped Thomas Jefferson negotiate with France. Dupont was the one who came up with the idea of the large Louisiana Purchase rather than just purchasing New Orleans.
Right, because that was the original objective.
Yes.
Yeah.
Just to get the port.
Right.
Jefferson was trying really hard to avoid war with France, and so he sent James Monroe to Paris to negotiate with instructions to go to London and ally with them if the Paris negotiations failed. By this time, Napoleon had basically given up on rebuilding France's New World Empire because he wasn't getting enough revenue from the sugar colonies in the Caribbean, so he didn't really need Louisiana anymore either.
Right.
He began considering selling the entire territory to the U.S. in April of 1803, even though his foreign minister Talleyrand was opposed. That's a good name.
Because he was fairly cash-strapped at this point.
Yes.
You know, conquering Europe turns out to be pretty expensive.
Who knew? But anyway, Talleyrand.
Talleyrand, yeah.
In the negotiations, the Americans were prepared to buy just New Orleans for $10 million, and then France offered them $15 million for the entire territory, which comes to about $320 million today. So, like, that's a real good deal.
Right. You offer $10 million for New Orleans, and they said, you know what, for 50% more, we'll increase the amount of territory you're gaining by 1,000%.
Well, I don't think they offered anything. I think France came to them first with $15 million, and they were like, well, our plan was in their, you know, in their minds.
Oh, I see,
they were
I
like,
see.
Our plan was to just get New Orleans for $10 million,
right.
So, like, how can we not take this?
Right, take the deal and run. Yeah,
right.
For sure.
And they were actually worried about Napoleon changing his mind and withdrawing the offer, so the Americans signed the Louisiana Purchase on April 30th, 1803, just a couple weeks after they got the offer.
Makes sense.
Yeah. And the signers were James Monroe, Robert Livingston, and François Barbet Marbois, who was from France.
Oh, was he?
Robert Livingston was like a lawyer from New York.
He was the other American representative, yeah.
Yeah. The treaty was publicly announced on July 4th, 1803, and they had until October to ratify it. Jefferson thought about a constitutional amendment to justify the purchase, but his cabinet advised against it. Ultimately, Jefferson decided that the purchase was constitutional because it was done to protect the United States citizens. The Federalists strongly opposed the purchase because it would bring closer ties to France rather than to Britain. Both the Federalists and the Jeffersonians were unsure about the purchase's constitutionality. The House of Representatives actually had a vote to deny the purchase request, but it failed by just 2 votes.
Wow.
Things haven't changed that much.
Nope.
The Senate quickly ratified the treaty, but the U.S. didn't have enough money to pay for it, so they borrowed the $15 million from Great Britain with an interest rate of 6%.
So France is threatening Great Britain because they're just, like, rampaging through Europe. The U.S. buys the territory from France, borrows the money from Britain to do so. Wow. Okay.
Feels sneaky.
Feels needlessly complicated.
Yes, it does.
Huh.
There's more complications with Spain and who got what, but I didn't even get into that.
Okay.
Spain finally turned the territory over to France on November 30th, just 1 month before France turned it over to the Americans. As of October 1st, 1804, the territory was organized into the Territory of Orleans, which was mostly what is Louisiana today, and the District of Louisiana, which was the rest of it. Very confusing.
Right.
New Orleans was the capital of the Orleans Territory, and St. Louis was the capital of the Louisiana Territory. The territory spanned from the Gulf of Mexico in the south to Rupert's Land, Canada, to the north, and the Mississippi River in the east to the Rocky Mountains in the west.
Right.
It doubled the size of the United States.
I was just talking last week about how the Erie Canal, like, opened up all of this territory to the rest of the world.
Right.
So that's an interesting bit of synergy.
Yep. Even after the purchase, there was a dispute between the U.S. and Spain about the exact borders of the territory. Spain believed that it was no more than the western bank of the Mississippi River and the cities of New Orleans and St. Louis. The dispute was finally resolved in 1819 when they signed the Adams-Onis Treaty with the U.S., getting most of what they originally claimed in the West.
Man,
the U.S. got mostly of what, you know what
right.
I'm saying.
Man, remember when, like, governments were functional and countries, like, negotiated with each other in good faith?
No.
Me neither.
Okay.
What a weird concept.
Yep. Even after that, the western boundary of the territory was contested. President Jefferson sent three teams to go explore and map the new territory. The Lewis and Clark expedition went up the Missouri River, the Red River expedition went to the Red River Basin, and the Pike expedition went to explore the Arkansas River watershed. Of course, this exploration and movement led to the movement of Americans westward and the establishment of the American West. It also greatly impacted the Native Americans in the area, but we should probably devote an entire discussion to that someday.
To all of the horrible shit that the United States did.
Yes.
To its Native populations. Yes.
Okay, one more.
All right, so I need this answer to tie.
Correct.
All right.
It is arts and literature.
Okay.
Although his cousin was the founder of America's oldest gun maker, and the rest of his family fought in most of the American wars, what man chose instead to study art at Yale and later became one of the main artists known for painting images of the Old West?
What?
What?
I don't know. That's a very hard question.
Thank you.
All right. So the oldest gun maker in the U.S., that has to be the critical clue. So that would either be Colt or Smith and Wesson, probably. Cousins don't necessarily share last names anyway. Wait a minute. I think I just thought of it. It's not Colt and it's not Smith and Wesson. The oldest gun maker, and I think there is an artist with this last name, although I can't recall his first name off the top of my head, is Remington. I'm going to say it's Remington.
It's Remington.
What is the first name? Because I don't
Frederick
know.
Frederick Remington.
Frederick Remington. I have heard
I bet
of
you've
this.
Never heard the gun maker's first name.
The first name? No.
Yeah.
What? Okay.
Oh, I could tell you.
Yes, please.
Eliphalet.
Eliphalet?
Yep.
Say that again.
Eliphalet.
Like an elephant, but you kind of give up halfway through?
Yep.
Cool.
Okay. Frederick Remington was an American painter, sculptor, illustrator, and writer. He was born on October 4th, 1861, in Canton, New York, which is close to the border of Canada. His father's family originally owned hardware stores and came from Alsace-Lorraine in France in the early 18th century. His mother's family was French Basque and founded the town of Windsor, Connecticut in the early 1600s.
What? Okay.
Yep.
Cool.
His father was a Union Army colonel in the American Civil War, and his other family members also fought in the French and Indian War, the American Revolution, and the War of 1812. His cousin, Eliphalet Remington, founded the Remington Arms Company in 1816, and we can talk about them another time. Frederick was an only child and got a lot of attention, but he was a poor student. When he was 11 years old, his family moved to Ogdensburg, New York, where he took his first drawing lessons. He would also draw caricatures and silhouettes of his classmates. Like I said in the question, he went to the art school at Yale University. While there, he didn't really enjoy doing still lifes and preferred to do action drawings. His first published illustration was a cartoon for the student newspaper of a bandaged football player. He was also on the football team himself. Unfortunately, he had to leave Yale to take care of his father, who had tuberculosis.
Yikes.
Yeah. After his father died, he became a reporter for his uncle's newspaper. He then decided just to travel with his inheritance. He traveled to the American West, where he saw the scenes he had been picturing since childhood. He moved to Kansas City with his wife, Eva Catton, but she left him and he stayed and began sketching and painting more seriously. He then returned to New York, where he started studying at Art Students League of New York in Brooklyn. His first full-page cover appeared in Harper's Weekly in 1886. For Harper's Weekly, he went to Arizona to cover the government's war against Geronimo. After returning to New York, he was sent again by Harper's Weekly to cover the 1886 Charleston earthquake, so he would go and draw. He made his drawings in black and white for commercial reproduction, but then began adding watercolors and selling them to art exhibitions. In 1887, he traveled to Canada and painted the Blackfoot, the Crow Nation, and the Canadian Mounties. Later that year, he was hired to do illustrations for a book by Theodore Roosevelt called Ranch Life in the Hunting Trail, and they kind of had a relationship after that.
Huh, that's cool.
Yeah. Soon after, his oil painting, Return of the Blackfoot War Party, was exhibited at the National Academy of Design. He was considered distinctive and modern. He also painted the famous mule train crossing the Sierras around that time. He became a favorite of the Western Army, who would invite him out west to paint their portraits in the field and give them national publicity through Harper's Weekly. It also gave him exclusive access to them and made him more famous for being the soldier artist, they called him.
That's a pretty cool moniker.
Yeah. In 1889, he won a medal at the Paris Exposition after being selected by the American Committee to represent American painting. His first solo show was in 1890 at the American Art Galleries. In 1895, he became considered a historian artist to paint memories of the Old West, because at that point it was done.
Right. Something barbed wire ended the Old West or something.
Sure.
I remember that from U.S. history in high school, I think.
Okay, I don't know.
Something about, like, barbed wire contained cattle, and so, like, the Old West culture just imploded in, like, a year.
Interesting.
Yeah. I don't really remember the details of that. Maybe I should look up.
Yeah, I don't
look
know.
Look it up, I don't know.
Also at that time, he began sculpting, his first sculpture being a Bronco Buster on a horse rearing on its hind legs.
That's the famous one. That's what he's known for, is that sculpture, right?
Yeah. Yeah. In 1897, he was hired as a war correspondent and illustrator for William Randolph Hearst's New York Journal. He went to Cuba both before and after the USS Maine exploded. His experience...
Which I have talked about.
Yes.
In my first Unsolved Quizduries episode, I think?
I think so.
Season one?
Sounds right.
I think. Don't go back and listen to that. The audio quality is real bad.
Yes. His experience shattered his conception of war being heroic, and his next painting, Scream of the Shrapnel, depicted more of the actual horrors of war that were there. After he was dropped by Harper's Weekly in 1900, he wrote and illustrated a full-length novel called The Way of an Indian, which depicted a stereotypical Native American. In 1902, he wrote another novel, John Ermine of the Yellowstone. In 1905, Collier's devoted an entire issue to Remington, showcasing his latest works. In 1908, he had his large sculpture of a cowboy erected in Philadelphia's Fairmount Park. Yeah, it's a big one of the guy on the cowboy on the horse.
Wait, have we been to that park when we lived in Philly?
Yeah.
Oh.
It's the big one in Fairmount.
I don't remember that.
It's the one you can drive through.
Oh.
It's huge.
Right, yes. Okay, yeah, yeah. I know what you're talking about. Okay, yeah, right.
Yeah.
Okay.
He began getting less popular, and one day he burned dozens of his oil paintings in his backyard to make a statement that he was done with illustration. Probably worth tens of millions of dollars.
Ugh.
On December 26, 1909, he died after an emergency appendectomy led to peritonitis. His home at the end of his life in Ridgefield, Connecticut, is now a National Historic Landmark called the Frederick Remington House.
Stands to reason.
Yep. That's it.
All right.
Yep. Good stuff.
Yeah, interesting. Okay, so that's the end of the game. I got 4 correct answers, just as you did last week. So we are currently tied 4-4 on the season. And that brings us, of course, to our favorite part of the show, Fact or Fucked. This is when a listener can send in either a true fact, the weirder the better, or something they just made up that they think they can pass off as a true fact, and they can see if they can stump us. Alright, so today's Fact or Fucked comes to us from our good friend Moxie. She is the host of the Your Brain on Facts podcast, one of my absolute favorite podcasts. So check her out on Twitter at Brain on Facts Pod, and download the Your Brain on Facts podcast wherever you listen to this. It is phenomenal. She is far more professional than we are about this.
Yep.
Here's what she says. The Estonian government's digital strategy is named for a folklore monster made of tools and hay.
That's weird that it's about Estonia.
Considering we spoke about Estonia fairly recently.
Yes.
Yeah.
I don't know. Fact.
It is fact.
Wow.
Yes, so...
That's super weird.
According to interestingengineering.com, which is where I fact-checked this, Estonia's AI, like government-sponsored AI that is being deployed in various private sector applications, is called KRATT AI. K-R-A-T-T.
Okay.
And in Estonian mythology, a krat is a magical creature brought to life from hay or metal household objects that is animated by a human soul.
Those are very different things.
Essentially, the krat is a servant made by its maker out of hay or old household tools to help with tasks. The Estonian government uses this character as a metaphor for artificial intelligence and its complexities.
That's weird.
So yes, that is real.
Fascinating. I guess it makes sense.
That's one of those ones that, like, it sounds like it should be made up, but it's real.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, Moxie, love it. That's awesome. And everybody should go listen to Your Brain on Facts. It is a much better podcast than this. So, that'll do it for this week, then. So, we are tied on the season, and you will have the chance to take the lead next week. And I bet you have some idea of what my theme is going to be, just given the way the calendar is falling.
Oh, but you promised me that I could have it this year.
No, I didn't.
Yes, you did.
No, we discussed this, and I'm taking the Halloween episode because your next episode falls on November 1st when Halloween is already over and we're on a Thanksgiving.
Oh, you're right, we did.
Yeah.
That's sad.
Sorry.
It's not fair.
Halloween, to quote Captain Raymond Holt from Brooklyn Nine-Nine.
Yeah, whatever, man.
Anyway, tune in next week for our Halloween special.
Yep.
All right, see you then.
Bye. The Lewis and Clark Expedition. Whatever, exposition.
I don't know.
The Lewis and Clark Expedition went up the Missouri River.
Try that again.